This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Donald Trump's contempt for democracy is a matter of fact, an impulse registered again and again throughout his presidency and its aftermath. As so many, including those in his circle, warned, he would never accept the legitimacy of Biden's election. And of course, he provoked an insurrection attempting to stop that election, and he has faced no consequences for it so far. There was some buzzing after the midterm elections that Trump's influence on the GOP had finally burned out. But the fact is that he's running for president, and he leads the Republican field. In 2018, at the midpoint of the Trump presidency, the journalist and historian John Meacham wrote a book called The Soul of America, and it warned of the gravity of Trump's threat to democracy. Now, this was hardly a unique point of view, but Meacham's particular way of putting things, steeped in a kind of critical reverence for American history, hit home with one reader in particular, Joe Biden. And in the years since, Meacham became an informal advisor to Biden, helping him with the last State of the Union address and other speeches. John Meacham's books include biographies of Jefferson, Jackson, George H.W. Bush, John Lewis, and Abraham Lincoln. We spoke last week. John, the press spends a huge amount of time obsessing about the odds, the mood, the events of the day. Let's talk about the stakes. As we witness the renewed and unending tragedy of Donald Trump, his candidacy, his battles with the law from New York to Georgia to D.C., what is at stake now in this latest chapter?
What's at stake is whether America now has 47 or 48% of the likely electorate to show up in 2024 who are more likely than not to vote for an overtly autocratic figure for president of the United States. Someone who has explicitly said that the rule of law should not apply to him. The results of free and fair elections should not be obeyed if he loses them.
The District Attorney of New York, under the auspices and direction of the Department of Injustice in Washington, D.C., was investigating me for something that is not a crime, not a misdemeanor, not an affair.
Having a dictatorial figure is not new, either in human experience or American history. What is new is that so many people are willing to suspend their better judgment to support him.
Did we make a mistake? Did many people not make a mistake thinking that with the results of the last election and then the spectacle of January 6th, that this somehow, this impulse of authoritarianism would begin to recede, and maybe even recede fairly rapidly? Was that not a gigantic illusion?
That's a good way to put it. It was a gigantic illusion, and it's a persistent one. I am friends with principled Republicans who have said to me, for going on 8 years now, since 2015, that Trump was going to fade, that it wouldn't work, that his hour either A, would not come, or B, would pass. And I now refer to this, overly glibly, as the Republican Brigadoon fantasy, that there is this world where Trump just disappears, and that world's going to come back and reassert itself. And the only problem with that fantasy is that it is fact-free. And it is a trope that every election is more important than any other election. But this is not 1976. This isn't 1980. This isn't a difference of degree, which is what presidential elections tend to be. Partisans don't believe that, but I believe that. It's a difference of kind.
But when we're assessing where Donald Trump came from, I think a lot of people would argue that some of the origins come from people that you have studied and have admired, whether it's the Lee Atwater side of the George H.W. Bush campaign or Ronald Reagan speaking for states' rights in Mississippi, that elements of Trumpism have been present in the Republican Party, in the establishment, for a very long time. So when you're assessing where Trumpism came from, how do you begin to analyze the roots of it?
I am more skeptical of the long-term Republican complicity in Trumpism for this reason. Trumpism was not inevitable, unless you go back to an elemental argument about human nature, which is that power is all. And I simply don't believe that the Republican figures that are kind of corralled up in this particular critique would have acted that way. I don't think Ronald Reagan would have done it. Richard Nixon broke the law, but then he followed the law. Nixon, in the end, had a sense of shame. And we're not there.
Now John, speaking of stakes, your involvement, your personal involvement in the stakes have shifted. You had a long and storied career as a journalism.
Storied. I like that. I'm storied.
That's what we say in sports, the storied fullback. And you more fully shifted to being a historian. You've written some remarkable and best-selling biographies, presidential biographies. The most recent is And There Was Light, about Lincoln. And yet, you also are getting more and more involved, or have been involved, particularly with Joe Biden as a kind of outside advisor, particularly on speeches. And I think it would be good to know what your association with Joe Biden is, how it began, and where it got to, how far it goes or how far it doesn't go.
15 years ago, I wrote a book called American Gospel. And Joe Biden was making, at that point, his second run for president. It lasted, I think, about 30 minutes. But he read that book. And after he was done with the campaign, or toward the end of his campaign, he actually took me aside at an event and showed me some laminated cards he had in his pocket that had quotations from the book. Now, as you know, when writers are shown their own words, we tend to approve of the taste and wisdom of the person who found those words.
You were flattered.
Absolutely, of course. Yeah. So, 2017, Vice President Biden, former Vice President Biden, had written the book about the loss of his son, Beau. And we did a book event here in Nashville. I interviewed him for a crowd. And so we became friendly. But my view of engagement, I spoke to the Democratic Convention at his request, and I have helped with the drafting of speeches, which I hate talking about, because if you're going to serve in that way, you shouldn't talk about it. But again,
did any of this make you feel uncomfortable? Because for journalists, you could be, you know, for somebody or against somebody editorially, in the obvious way, but to be writing speeches, to be speaking at a political convention, et cetera, that's another matter, no? Did you feel...
It is a matter. It is another matter. No, but I'm not a journalist anymore. I'm a biographer. I'm a professor. And I believe firmly that to whom much is given, much is expected. I don't want to profit from this. I see this as an act of citizenship. And I believe that Trumpism is a fundamental threat to the things that we have long held dear. And so I want, if I can be of help in articulating a vision of the country that puts the Declaration, that puts the pursuit of justice, that puts the best of the country front and center, then I want to do that.
Many books are written about Abraham Lincoln. Many, many, many biographies. There are so many books written about Lincoln that I believe every year there's an award given to the best book about Abraham Lincoln. Your book is at once a biography, but I also think it resonates very, very deliberately, if not overtly, with the present moment. Was that the impetus for the book, and how does it resonate to you?
In many ways, it was. So I thought that our current moment was like 1933 or 1968, where there were proto-fascist forces. There was a sense that democracy had run out its string, and that enough conscientious effort went into keeping democracy alive. I am increasingly concerned, however, having made that argument, that this is the 1850s, that in fact there are competing visions of reality itself.
Stop the steal! Stop the steal! Stop the steal!
And we are going to fight like hell against the tyrannical Democrats and any Republicans who do deals with them. It will be your peril if you underestimate this movement again.
It was not settled by a congressional debate. It was not settled by a Brookings seminar. It was not settled through the ordinary protocols of politics. It was settled by the sword, by the Civil War, by the death of what demographers now believe might have been 750,000 Americans. And what I wanted to explore, and Lincoln rests at the center of this question, is why did Abraham Lincoln, why did he do what he did? Because he was a politician. Abraham Lincoln, for all of his failings, fundamentally believed that slavery was wrong and could not be expanded. And so why? Why did he think that? He thought it and acted on it because his conscience told him so. Lincoln put the moral convictions of anti-slavery at the center of his undertaking. And he didn't have to.
I think what you're saying by inference is that in no small measure, that the burden on Joe Biden and Joe Biden's candidacy, presumably for re-election, is of that historical weight. And if he does not succeed, then we don't know what the consequences could be. People were mocking about the recent book by Barbara Walter about the possibility of civil war in this country, but you seem to be inviting that potential comparison, So that's one thing. The other thing is Joe Biden up to it? Abraham Lincoln's capacities, his eloquence, was extraordinary by any measure. Joe Biden is an older guy whose eloquence is not Lincoln-esque. And he also has a lot of other things on his plate, including a land war in Europe and any number of other issues impinging on him, to say nothing about the fate of the planet itself. Is Joe Biden up to defeating Donald Trump again and at the same time righting this country?
The question, I believe, is as much, are we up to it as President Biden? President Biden is not, no American president is Zeus-like. And so I think it's up to 51% of us or more to recognize what path we should take and take it. And so I wouldn't put the whole onus on any single person, including Lincoln. The Union Army had a lot to do with this. Black Americans had a lot to do with this. I think the person at the top matters enormously, obviously. But this is up to all of us.
Do you think Ron DeSantis represents Trumpism or some other kind of Republicanism?
I'm not an early investor in the Ron DeSantis conventional wisdom. I think the Trump grip on that base of folks is so strong that it's just going to be, it's very hard for me to see how he doesn't win the nomination. And I know, again,
what role will legal indictment play in that?
It could help. That's the world we're in, right? Is that
indictment in Georgia, indictment in Washington, indictment in New York, any of them could help, you're saying?
I think so. I mean, I don't see, we're in uncharted territory, but to have an indicted former president seeking re-election with a huge chunk of a formerly functional opposition political party in the United States is unprecedented. What is not unprecedented is the case that has to be made to defeat him. And that is a case for a constitutional order informed by a journey toward recognizing the promise of human equality that was articulated, if not realized, at the beginning of the adventure. And the great question for my Republican friends is, do you have the ability, do you have the capacity to vote for the other party in order to preserve the experiment? I don't have a partisan enough brain to even think that's a hard call. I have voted for Republican presidential candidates. I am flummoxed to some extent at the durability of partisan feeling. Your colleague Susan Glasser and Peter Baker have reported that James Addison Baker III voted for Donald Trump twice.
I mean, isn't that outrageous to your ear?
Yes, and I don't understand it. A man who gave a huge chunk of his life to a constitutional experiment to preserving America's role in the world, voted for the nominee of his party, no matter who the nominee was. And I just don't understand it.
But then what gives you the notion that, you know, that somehow that this fever will break?
The fever only breaks if they lose. Let's be very clear here. The only way that Trumpism recedes from its power, and it's, you're never getting rid of it, right? But it can be contained. my view is it is only contained if they keep losing.
And that means that democracy, American democracy, is on is on the edge at all times, and that we didn't recognize it.
Of course it's on the edge at all times. Of course, it's fundamentally a human enterprise. We can't outsource this. I'm not talking about, this is important to me, David. I'm not arguing that there is a mythical moment, that there is a moment at Gettysburg on the farm with Eisenhower where if we could just beam ourselves back there, everything was great and everything will be great again. It is a perennial struggle. It is a perennial battle, I have argued, between our worst instincts and the better angels of our nature, to use Lincoln's phrase. And the remarkable thing about the American experiment is that after much blood, much strife, much chaos, those better angels have just managed to eke out a provisional victory. And I think that's the struggle we're in now.
John Meacham, thanks so much.
Thank you.
John Meacham is a recovering journalist and a presidential historian. He's also a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. His book about Abraham Lincoln from last year is called And There Was Light. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the late 70s and into the 80s, Brooke Shields was one of the most famous and controversial people in America. But if she was somehow notorious, it had nothing to do with her exactly. It was the position that she was put in as a child actress and as a young model. When she was 11, she starred in Pretty Baby, playing a child prostitute. And when she was 15, she starred in a heavy-breathing desert island love story called Blue Lagoon. And there was a notorious series of ads for Calvin Klein jeans that set a new benchmark for skeezy suggestiveness. So for a while there, Brooke Shields seemed to be at the center of everything that appalled or titillated people about the era. A new documentary about the life of Brooke Shields is airing next week on Hulu.
My next guest is really a beautiful young lady who at 13 has already achieved an incredible amount of recognition. Brooke Shields starred in the highly publicized film Pretty Baby, and she's the subject of a new book called The Brooke Book. She is quite a fascinating young lady. Would you welcome, please, Miss Brooke Shields.
Shields spoke the other day with The New Yorker's Michael Shulman.
I really didn't realize the extent to which you lived your entire life in the public eye. I mean, it seems like you were you know, from infancy, you were modeling. Do you have memories of like coming to realize that your life was unusual in some way?
Here's the problem with that way of, not your way of thinking, but that kind of rationale is I never knew anything different. So I think I've seen, especially actors, go from anonymity to fame sort of in one movie or overnight. And the shock to their system, how much their world changes is what undoes them, you know? Whereas I only knew working and I only knew school and jobs. That's what you did. And I only worked from 3 o'clock on. Even if they would be like, oh, there's a 10 o'clock appointment for her. And my mom would be like, all right, we'll see you at 3. You know, then they were like, but it's at 10 o'clock. And she's like, she's in school.
Right. So much of the documentary are these clips of you on talk shows sitting across from some middle-aged man asking you to essentially defend yourself or asking creepy, prurient questions about your sexuality or your love life. And then you are usually sitting next to your mother and kind of making the case for how this is fine. And I just, there's so many of those clips. And I, in a way, I feel like self-conscious right now because I'm also someone doing that in a way, like asking you about the kind of complicated morality of this work. But how did you feel sort of sitting in those chairs, like being on talk shows, being sort of interrogated like that?
It just never ended. I mean, there were some clips later where, or maybe this one made it in, I don't know, where you can see me go, oh, here we go again. Like I became this like, you know, vaudeville kind of like, oh, look, here comes, you know, like a question or whatever. And I just sort of, I think it made me lose so much respect for the excuse me, but the press, because there was no one place that had even a modicum of integrity.
Brooke, what are your measurements?
I'm 5'10 and 120.
I think when people see you, they don't realize.
And to have Barbara Walters talk about my measurements, to have, you know, Phil Donahue or these people, you know, Tom Snyder and, you know, and they just like sort of, there was nothing intellectual about it. And so you saw these adults who you thought were supposed to be the smart people in the world be so lowest common denominator that I just became sort of shut down to all of it because I thought, here we go again. You know, and you watch this little girl and you think, shame on you guys. Like to me, I've put more blame and shame on the interviewers and the press than I ever would about Pretty Baby, the subject or the content or the, like that knew exactly what it set out to do. Mm-hmm. And it was an artistic endeavor. Then you get to these journalists and you think, how is that okay to talk to a child like that?
Right. It's, you know, very uncomfortable to watch.
It's uncomfortable to watch. And it's so, and I just learned at a very young age, you know, not to really trust people. And, you know, I used to think, oh, if I say this, I'll be liked, or, oh, the journalist is going to get it. They're going to see it, you know? And I just learned at a very early age that wasn't the nature of the industry, you know?
What I want to talk about next is a very complicated thing, which is Pretty Baby, not only the name of your documentary, but of course was also your breakout role in 1978 in the Louis Malle film, which...
Breakout role.
Is that
so funny?
Is that not the way to say
it? No, it's the way, it's so funny looking, like re-examining all of this and sort of thinking like, yeah, that's what they call a breakout.
This is Brooke Shields. Breathtaking in her screen debut. Constantly changing. Always surprising. Like the image of...
Do you think I'm pretty?
Yes, I certainly do.
You love my mother more than me. I know about those things better than you. You always know those things about men when you're a woman.
I watched it recently for the first time, and honestly, I loved it, but I also do not know what to think about it.
Oh, see, I think it's all. The most beautiful movie I've ever made. I think it's the only real quality film I've ever really been in. Mm. Like, I value that movie so in such a different way, and wrote my thesis on it, and this sort of the I'm fascinated with that journey of innocence to experience,
right,
you know,
right.
And how, who owns it and how they, you know, do they become a victim to it or do they not? And I don't know, it's just very interesting to me, that movie. You couldn't make it today. Obviously, that's what the big theme is now. It's like, oh, you couldn't make that movie today. I mean, you couldn't.
But it is a beautifully done film, and it's, you know, it's about a young woman who lives in a whorehouse in turn of the century New Orleans, and this young girl's transition from, in a way, as you were saying, thinking, not knowing that this isn't anything but normal,
right?
And then kind of following her mother's footsteps and, you know, becoming a sex worker herself. How was the character and the plot described to you, and who described it?
I went in and just talked with Polly Platt and with Louis Malle, and he just asked me questions like, are you aware of what prostitution is? And I was like, yeah, you know, I often see on 42nd Street the girls standing on the corner, and, you know, I always worry that they're cold, and, you know, and so I just told him those stories about that. And growing up in Manhattan, you know, I was a city kid, so... And I was a city kid with a single mom. So, you know, I saw New York in the 70s in a very sort of raw way. That was how I grew up. And then he just, you know, asked me questions about the era, you know, the early 1900s and what the wardrobe looked like. And he said, you know, we're telling the story. It's a true story. It's about a young girl. And it's a love story. Ostensibly, it's a love story, but it's also, he wouldn't have said coming of age at that point because I don't think I would have understood it. But he was talking about the mother and the daughter. And we talked about like my hobbies, like what I liked doing. I liked riding horses. And I think he just wanted, it wasn't about a proficient performer or a Lolita. It was about the innocence in an innocent, and how that innocence gets sort of taken, but her choice to not be a victim. And you see it at the end of the film cinematically when she turns around and looks into the camera, and it's the first time she, you know, looks right down the barrel of the lens, and there's a young sort of newsy boy behind her, and he's blurred, and that's the last sort of frame, and how she sort of turns that being sheep in a voyeuristic environment, she then turns it around and says, okay, I'm in control now. You want me to put a bow in my hair and be a kid? I gotcha. And it's this, like, to me, I don't think I knew that until later when I really analyzed the film.
Right. I'm always fascinated by what child actors understand about what they're doing, especially when they give an incredible film performance.
Well, it's hard to know. You know, no one was teaching me anything. So I wasn't being shepherded in any way. But it was interesting because when I had the kissing scene with Keith.
Keith Carradine, who plays the photographer who becomes your...
husband.
Kind of, yeah, your husband.
We get married. And I had never, you know, kissed a boy before. And
you're 11 in this movie,
11.
Right?
I'm 11. And I didn't know how to do that. And I had a kiss. I'd never, you know, and I was like, oh God, I don't know what to do. And so I kept scrunching up my face, and the director kept getting mad at me. And so Keith says, can I just have a minute with her? And he said, you know, I mean, he was in a very difficult position. I think he must have. I mean, I don't know. I never really spoke to him about it in later years, but it must have been kind of just hard for him, you know, because
yeah, time to kiss an 11-year-old.
I know. I mean, it's weird. And he said to me, you know, this doesn't count as a first kiss. Mm-hmm. And I will always be thankful for that.
It's just so different from anything now. And I love how the documentary ends with you talking to your daughters, who I guess are Gen Zers.
I guess, yeah, I think so. That's, yeah, they're 16 and 19.
You haven't seen Pretty Baby. You haven't seen Blue Lagoon. No. You haven't seen Endless Love.
No. I will never, ever watch Blue Lagoon. Sorry.
Okay.
Why not Blue Lagoon?
Because she's like, naked?
No, I see Pretty Baby edits on TikTok and it makes me not want to watch it.
Shh. Because it's like the movie itself is like, that. This is nothing against,
no. I'm not talking personally.
The movie itself is like about something that's not okay now, right?
See, I never saw Pretty Baby. Is there nudity in it?
Yes.
Are you nude?
I'm nude twice. With my little 11-year-old body.
Yeah, that's weird.
Weird. Why wouldn't you be able to see that movie today? Why wouldn't that movie be able to be made today?
Like, it's just everything's changed.
It's called child pornography, technically.
You were 11. You weren't mature enough to be making your own decisions. And other people signed off being like, oh, no, she's fine. You can take her top off. She's fine.
They blew me away at the end of when, because they weren't prompted at all. And I didn't know that they were aware of any of that or thought that way or, you know, and it was interesting that to see them say that what they felt about it.
Right.
You know, and I was proud of them for being able to be able to talk about all of it. I mean, I don't know. It's again, you know, you can't really say like, oh, it was just a different era. It was a different era.
Mm-hmm.
And
like Gen Z knows so much about consent now and thinks about it a lot.
Right.
That seemed to be what your daughters were saying is that how could you have had consent over being nude at 11?
And I wouldn't have known to say no or that I could have said no. But it also didn't occur to me to say no.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it seemed like, and this is one thing I really learned watching the documentary, is that basically everything you did became what we would in the present time call a discourse, you know, whether it was the Calvin Klein commercials, which people thought were too sexy.
You want to know what comes between me and my Calvins? Nothing.
Calvin Klein jeans.
I was curious if you've read, the supermodel Emily Ratajkowski's book, My Body?
No, but I'm going to be on her podcast and she's going to be on mine. And so I'm getting the book and I'm going to read it, obviously, before I speak to her.
I mean, yeah, well,
it's interesting.
I was thinking about watching the documentary about you because, like you, she was, you know, the face. And in this book, it's a book of essays and she really grapples with what it means to kind of like make a living off of your image and your beauty. Wait, I'm gonna, I have a quote from it that I thought was really. Whatever influence and status I've gained were only granted to me because I appealed to men. My position brought me in close proximity to wealth and power and brought me some autonomy, but it hasn't resulted in true empowerment. And she's talking about sort of participating in like the influencer economy and sort of being the face of whatever brands, you know, and I'm curious, like, do you, you know, when you, you know, had the Calvin Klein jeans ads, it almost seems like a catch-22 in that, you know, you're sort of criticized for being too sexy in those ads. And yet also the people doing that are like, the people profiting from it is Calvin Klein jeans.
But that's your job. I mean, you're selling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So it's like, I can't be a hypocrite. And on the one hand say, I'm going to sell your stuff and I'm going to sell it however however I can, you know, and if this is what it is, then that's what I'm going to do. Because it was acting, you know, but I don't then get to turn around and sort of negate it or put it down or say like, oh, I'm being used. Yeah. That's what you do. You know, it's like, right. I don't believe in like this righteous kind of all of a sudden. It's like, I'm sorry, but you know exactly you're making money and you're selling something. And in most cases, you know, sex sells, right? So come on, like, dude, just shut the up.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm being objectified. You're a model.
Right.
It's the point. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not being negative about that because I think she's very right about what her perception of that is. But by the same token, like, I don't believe in having a poor me.
Well, in a way, what you're saying is very consistent with what you were saying at 12 and 15 on these talk shows, which is that I knew exactly what I was doing getting to this, and it's fine. I mean, do you feel like what has changed, if anything, about your perspective on your early career just as you've gotten older and lived more life? I mean, do you feel like you have the same opinion on it as you did then?
Pretty much. I mean, yes, I answer my children and saying, you know, would that be a world that I would put them in then or now? And the answer is no, but they're different people. This is a different time and I have a different perspective, but I don't, do I have a different perspective about my career? I think I don't think I've really changed. I mean, I feel like at every step of the way, every time someone criticized, it so clearly became about them to me.
Mm.
You know, and I would watch it time and time and time again, and I'd think, you're the one with the problem, and you want me to have this problem.
Mm.
And I can't grant you that because I don't. That is not my perspective. Now, that's hard for you to take because then I'm not a victim. Then what does that mean? And then it reflects back onto you in some way that you think. Like, so I'm proud of the way that I was able to maintain my point of view.
Documentary Pretty Baby, Brooke Shields, is on Hulu starting April 3rd. You can also read her interview with Michael Shulman at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're going to close the show today with the New Yorker's Khalifa Saneh. Khalifa writes about politics, sports, music. He is absolutely passionate about music. His book, Major Labels, is a history of popular music, genre by genre. And in the New Yorker, he wrote recently about an artist I wasn't familiar with who goes by the name Hardy.
Hardy.
Hardy Hardy.
In this case, Michael Hardy, who's kind of made his name as a country singer and songwriter. And he has a new song on his new album called Radio Song that I wanted to play for you.
All right, here we go.
So his radio song is a country song that can't be played on country radio.
I can hear that.
And it's part of his shift. His new album is half country music and half rock music.
What's his story?
He's a guy who grew up in Philadelphia, Mississippi. So he grew up culturally country, but that wasn't really what he listened to. He was listening to, you know, I think it started with Pearl Jam and it went into like Linkin Park, System of a Down.
Oh, you can hear the Linkin Park
yes.
roaring through it.
New metal, listening to the music that is sometimes referred to as butt rock.
Okay, all right. What is that?
It's as far as we know, the phrase butt rock comes from...
How are we spelling it?
Spelled with two T's.
There we go.
But it comes from the rock radio stations that promised to play nothing...
But rock.
Exactly.
Got it. Oh, my God.
So he, and it's funny, like, it's such an old-fashioned tradition now. You turn on these stations, and they're still playing Metallica, and they're playing, you know, old songs, and they're playing, like, Papa Roach and Disturbed, like, new albums by these bands. And so in this context, Hardy is kind of a breath of fresh air. He has a song on rock radio right now called Jack.
So crazy. So it starts out country, and by the time you know, three lines later, you're in Linkin Park land.
Well, yeah, and the whole second half of his album is rock. And, you know, I have a theory that, you know, there was a time not that long ago when country music was, like, considered the most uncool music in the country, mm-hmm. right? Like, and people, you know, coastal elites love to sneer at country music. I think maybe it has now been overtaken by rock. I think that kind of like loud mainstream rock, new metal, sort of post-grunge is now kind of the most unfashionable music in America. I think so.
Among coastal,
yeah, and I think by comparison, that's why someone like Hardy, who arrives from the country world, is able to sort of bring some fresh energy to it.
So Hardy outlined what makes a song, a radio hit in the first track that we played. What makes this song good for rock radio?
Well, it's a specific tradition, right? It's this thing that happened since grunge, where it was a lot of minor keys, and then in the late 90s and the early 2000s, you get the heaviness, you get the breaks. Hardy, I talked to Hardy, he told me, you know, there was a point in high school where he just wanted to hear something that was heavy. And if it was, you know, these kind of hardcore and metalcore bands, punk bands like A Day to Remember or August Burns Red, he just wanted like a heavy mosh part.
So at the Super Bowl and then at the Grammys again, you've seen hip-hop celebrated and venerated as almost a historical genre.
Yeah.
Is rock and roll so dead that it's beneath consideration?
It sometimes feels that way. I think one of the things that happens is that rock and roll is just more traditional. It's not that it's about chasing the latest trends. It's that different styles kind of get resurrected. You know, there's a band on rock radio right now called Giovanni and the Hired Guns. They are self-described Tejano punk boys from Texas.
Right.
And, you know, so they're drawing from, you know, a lot of bands like Weezer, Blink 182, but also the Norteño music that they grew up on. This is a song they have called Overrated, and you can kind of hear those traditions colliding. So please note the tuba.
Listen to the lead singer's voice, though. Who does that remind you of?
Who does it remind you of?
Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, well, yes, the shadow of Kurt Cobain, you know, is a long shadow. And it's amazing how there's a sense in which rock and roll has never really recovered from the shock of Nirvana, at least that kind of rock.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, you think about the hair metal era.
Right.
Lasts, what, 4 or 5 years, right? Yeah. From 85, 86, and then it ends in maybe 91. Whereas the grunge and the post-grunge era feels like it never really goes away.
Right.
It's incredible.
Now, this music also seems influenced by, let's bring the personal into this, you were in bands when you were young, mm-hmm. kind of punk bands,
yeah,
playing bass. There's a little bit of that power in there, too.
Yes, that's the idea that, like, there's some kids out there that want to scream at the top of their lungs. That's a very, that's a very common and popular idea. And it's also the fact that these cycles, they keep going. I mean, you know, we remember when the Strokes 20 years ago were, you know, borrowing an old Tom Petty riff from the 1970s
right.
and reusing it. So now we have bands like, there's this band Avoid, I think a very entertaining young band from Seattle, and they're dusting off the long ago sounds of the 2000s. I remember this stuff. Like, I was at those concerts, not as a kid, but as a music critic. And so I know, I think, a little bit how you must feel, David, which is
shut up.
extremely old.
Let's hear this.
Here's
Can't
Avoid.
Take This Away by Avoid. Some familiar moves in there.
I was going to say, if you listen closely,
that stop riff.
You can hear that little riff that you might recall. I know, as the editor of this magazine, you spend your days attending to weighty matters
like that.
Serious, but we can learn important lessons from a band like this. What I've learned from that song is that, as a great man once said, the arc of the rock universe is long, but it bends toward the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
These bands that you were playing, they remain outliers for the moment, or do you see them becoming mainstream?
Well, one thing that happened with rock and roll is that it's splintered, right? So you have indie rock over here, and then even on the radio, you have classic rock stations, you have alternative stations that are playing rock bands, but they're also playing Billie Eilish, and then you have like mainstream rock and active rock.
Who's listening to the radio?
Radio is still more popular than you would think. It still drives discovery, right? People are discovering new music on the radio.
Mainly in the car?
Often in the car, but also if people don't want to think too hard, right? Like you log on to Spotify and it gives you all these options. A lot of people just want to like push a button and have something come out and have someone maybe local talk a little bit about the weather and the traffic and play some songs that they're going to like.
There's a lesson in there for Netflix too, isn't there? Okay, it's a huge pleasure. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
You get to pick one more track. What should we go out on?
So there's this guy, Jelly Roll, tattooed former rapper mm-hmm. from Tennessee, who managed a pretty amazing feat. He went number one on both the country and the rock chart in the last year with different songs. This is his number one rock hit, Dead Man Walking.
The New Yorker's Kelly Fasane. You can read his writing on Hardy and 10,000 other subjects at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Brita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, Avery Keatley, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline, Michael May, David Gable, and Meher Bhatia. Special assistance this week from Mike Dodge Weisskopf of KCRW. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
The
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.